following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee.
This episode from Radioland is brought to you, as always, by our friends over at Central Barbecue. Those of you in Memphis know all about this fantastic place. Three locations, been around a long time. In fact, they are the number one barbecue joint in town. Now, those of you that don't live in Memphis are going, "Oh, that doesn't do us any good. We can't get it." Yeah, you can. Yes, you can have the taste of Memphis delivered right to your door. It's real easy to do. Go to their website, cbqmemphis.com, or you can find them probably where you found this show, radio-memphis.com. Look for the banner. It's at the very top of the page. It's the big banner. Look for the pig. He's kind of got that little glint in his eye. He says, "Come on and eat me. Come on and have some of this great stuff," and they'll deliver it to you anywhere in the United States of America. Yes, indeed. I heard they had a banner holiday season thanks to you folks. If you're hungry for it, you know where to get it. Central Barbecue. Proud sponsors from Radioland as we get the show started right now. Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, hey, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland, this time, from Studio B at Pirate Radio Studios, the home of Radio Memphis. Got to get that plug in because that's, well, not a plug in, but the plug in. That's what this whole show is about. It's to sort of whore out the radio station as best as we possibly can. Memphis music played here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I got a show on. You can catch me during the week. We're at 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. all time central. And it's all live. Everything you hear on the radio station is done live in studio. So that's a cool thing. Been watching the industry here of late and watching the demise of FM radio as it continues on. Another station up in St. Louis wound up blowing out a bunch of folks on air and off air as the big meltdown happens. And I shake my head and I wonder why this is, that they haven't embraced the new digital technology in the realms that they should have. Television has certainly done it. Internet radio stations are kind of coming in and stealing the slice of the pie here, which is good for us. We certainly are happy about that. But you know, that's indicative of the way things are going. I go everywhere, you've seen the same thing. Kids are, you know, they got their head bent down, their chin down in their chest. They're staring in their devices, their tablets, their phones. Laptops are not even, as popular as they once were because it's all mobile and weird and stuff. And I'm starting to be just as bad considering I feel like kind of an old man these days. But, you know, hey, you got to go. You got to roll with the punches. You got to deal with the time. And that's exactly what we're going to get into on this timeout. A little bit later on in this show, in this episode, we're going to have some music for you. Star and Micey going to perform for you with a great song, "I Can't Wait." It's coming up here in a little while. But first, my guest this time out is a good friend of mine. I've known him for many, many years, and we've been wanting to get him on. And this is good that this happened when it happened and how it happened. It actually came through my wife, the immigrant, Josephine. She's actually very good friends with our guest, and she ran into him and said, "Hey, we've been trying to get you on the show. Have you got any time?" And all of a sudden, bing, boom, bah, I'm on the phone. I'm on the phone with him, and he's like, I said, "Are you available?" He's like, "Yeah, sure, pick a date and time." So we worked it out, and he's here. Oh, my goodness, and we're going to talk about all sorts of fun stuff, including the impact of digital media on something that you probably would not have considered. Ladies and gentlemen, it's our good friend, Mr. Jerry the King Lawler. He's the king of Memphis wrestling for a reason. And I tell you what, he's been around for a long, long time, and he's going to be around for a long time more as well. Jerry, how you doing, my friend?
Rick, I couldn't be better. To be perfectly honest with you, I don't think I could be better.
Did you have a good holiday?
You know, I did. It was unique for me. I mean, it was like a first in the fact that about 5 months ago, my brother passed away, and he was the last remaining member of my immediate family. You know, it was my mom, my dad, my brother, and me. And of course, my parents have been gone for a while, and my brother passed away, passing 5 months ago. This was the first Christmas in my life without at least one member of my family being there. My brother and his wife would always come up from Mississippi and be at the house on Christmas Day. So that part of it was sad and different, you know, but other than that, everything was good.
Well, hell, a year ago, you had that heart thing. up in Canada. It's been a year, right? It was a year December, is that right?
Listen to you. You're like the people that I see. I mean, I run into somebody every day, and then all of a sudden they see me, and their just eyes get big, and they'll go, "Oh my gosh, it's so good to see you up and around. Are you doing okay?"
Yeah.
The heart issue you're talking about, I had a cardiac arrest live on the live television show on a Monday Night Raw in Montreal, Canada.
Yeah.
It's been over three years ago.
Is it 3 years?
Yes.
Oh my God, time has flown.
Time has flown, right?
Oh my God.
Time flies when you're living, right?
Well, there is that. I thought it was a year. I'm so sorry about that.
Yeah, well, no, I'm glad it's been 3 years.
It's been 3 years. I haven't had one moment's problem since. So,
that's good.
And that's why, you know, it kind of is funny to me when somebody
mentions
to me, it seems like forever ago. And honestly, it seems like it really didn't even happen. But when somebody looks at me and goes, "Oh, how are you doing? Good to see you healthy." You know, I mean, okay.
It was such a big deal, though, because it was live television and you scared the crap out of everybody around here.
Well, I didn't do it intentionally. I know that. But yeah, I mean, it was. I've tried to downplay it. I mean, it was a big deal. I had a cardiac arrest and basically died. I mean, I was sitting there doing a broadcast. I had just wrestled on live TV. Randy Orton and I were just partners against, Dolph Ziggler and somebody, maybe CM Punk, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, we just had this big match, and I came right down from the ring and was sitting down with my broadcast partner, Michael Cole, and we're commentating on the following match. And I swear to you, I didn't have, not 1 minute of pain, chest pain or anything. I didn't feel bad.
The symptoms of the left arm going
nothing,
numb.
Nothing. I'm just sitting there like it's a normal Monday night broadcast, which I've been doing for 23 years. And I'm talking to Michael and I'm looking up at the guys in the ring and I blink my eyes. And when I open them again, my girlfriend is standing there. I'm in a hospital bed in Montreal, Canada with a ventilator down my throat. And it was as if I'm just like dumbfounded. I said, you know, what is it? What happened? Where am I?
Yeah.
And so, of course, she explained that. I guess the big difference is I didn't technically have a heart attack that would be caused by clogged arteries.
Right.
In other words, I didn't have the heart attack where your blood flow is getting limited to your heart. That causes pain. That causes your symptoms and things
compression
like that.
That
you can tell is happening. I had a cardiac arrest, which I found out later, only 7 out of 1,000 people that have these things. And one person has every 90 seconds somewhere in the United States. But a cardiac arrest is, if for one reason or other, your heart just stops. Just boom. And you're dead, basically, unless you have immediate attention. And usually, if you're not already in a hospital when this happens, you don't survive. That's why I said 7 out of 1,000 people that have cardiac arrests survive. Fortunately for me, when I just boom had it, fell over from the announce table, I just boom passed, fell over to my left. And fortunately, at the WWE events, we have a ringside physician right there.
Oh, yeah.
And literally, the guy was sitting right next to me. Of course, he was there for the performers in the ring, basically. But boom, when I fell over dead right at his feet, he immediately started the chest compression and the CPR. And then they ripped my shirt off, got me to the back of the arena. And I don't even think they brought out a stretcher. I think they may have just sort of carried me back or whatever. But anyway, they got me to the back of the arena. And the guy told me later, our company doctor, he said, if it had just been me there, I wouldn't have been able to continue doing it because they didn't get my heart had stopped completely and they didn't get access to the paddles to restart me for 20 minutes.
Oh, my.
And so fortunately, there were two other paramedics, and he said they all three took turns just doing as hard a compression as they could for that 20 minutes. And then when they got the paddles, boom, they shocked me 7 times before my heart started. But the crazy thing was when my heart started back up again on its normal rhythm,
Everything was fine. Doctors said, "Get out of here. You're good."
Yeah. They took me onto the hospital and they had me sedated and everything after that. But when I woke up, it was like it didn't even happen. I couldn't believe that it happened.
Wow.
I still to this day have no real memory of it. And so it's like, that's why I say, you know, I can't relate to the people that are amazed to see me walking around because it's almost like it didn't really happen.
Yeah, well, I guess when they took your shirt off, did they see the S?
No, but
oh
when
my, God,
when my girlfriend came to see me, when my girlfriend got there the next day up in Montreal, she said there were like big burn marks on my chest.
Yeah.
And I guess that was from the, you know,
from the paddles
being shocked seven times, I guess. So it was like,
I'm told that's like getting kicked by a mule when they hit you with those things.
Well, I don't, once again,
but you were asleep. You didn't,
I didn't,
you
know. No, I was dead. Rick, I was dead.
You were dead. Right? Yeah. Let's call it like you see it.
Right.
But you know, I mean, with, I mean, thank God that happened in front of a live event. You had this, the whole audience there, you had the TV thing going on, but those shows, I mean, there's so many people that come to those anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, aside from the medical issues and stuff like that, I mean, that, this is something you've been doing for a long, long time.
I've been in the wrestling business, Rick, for 45 years.
Yeah.
And going on 46 now. I think I had my first match in 1971, something like that.
Yeah.
So a long time.
Yeah.
And it is just, I mean, you know, it's grown tremendously. I mean, I had my first match in West Memphis, Arkansas, in front of about maybe at the most 45 people.
Yeah.
We wrestled in a little makeshift. It was actually an old abandoned movie theater.
Yeah.
And that they had kind of reconfigured. The old screen had big rips in it and it was still down front, and they had taken out maybe 15 rows of seats and put in a little wrestling ring there.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the ring light over the ring was a big galvanized steel wash tub with a one wire hanging down and about 450 watt light bulbs inside it. And I'm looking up thinking, man, this is like Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, I hit the big time.
I hit the big time here at the Avon Theater in West Memphis, Arkansas. From that time until today, it's unbelievable the changes that I've seen in the business.
Yeah, your career is like the perfect arc too, because right at the time you were peaking, the WWE was becoming a really, really big thing, and now look at it, it's like the largest thing in global television.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, you know, the explosion happened in the mid to late 80s when with cable TV.
That was
the explosion of wrestling when the TV went from being syndicated and what we called back in the day territorialized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, like, of course, my hometown here in Memphis, Tennessee, wrestling was huge. It was the biggest thing ever, but it was still, you know, the wrestlers that were here, you watched either Channel 13 or Channel 5 mostly, but outside of the Channel 5 viewing area, those people didn't even know they didn't know who the Memphis wrestlers were. So, and it was the same thing, like in New York City, nobody in Memphis knew who was wrestling every week in New York City, and the New York people didn't know who was wrestling every week in Memphis. So you were a regionalized star. Then when cable TV came along and the shows got put on a national level, then of course, all the wrestlers wanted to work for the main company that was at the time WWE or WCW. There were two, one owned by Ted Turner, one owned by Vince McMahon. Those were the two companies that had their TV shows, their wrestling shows on national cable.
Right.
So then suddenly all the wrestlers wanted to work for them, because instead of just being seen in
a local venue,
boom, all of a sudden you're seen all over the country. So it'd make you, you know, a national star. So that's why all of these people started going to work for WWE or WCW, and the little regional areas kind of just died out. They dwindled away because of lack of talent. So that's been the biggest, you know, that's been the biggest change. That's what happened to what we used to call Memphis wrestling. I mean, you know, it just instead of being localized, it became on a national level with the WWE. And I held out as long as I could, because I was one of the owners. Me and Jerry Jarrett owned the Memphis Wrestling Company here.
Right.
So, you know, we looked at them as a company that was trying to put us out of business. And in reality, that is what was happening, but they weren't really trying to. They were just running their business. They just happened to be lucky enough to be on have cable TV.
I would have thought that what you were doing with Memphis Wrestling would have been sort of like the minor leagues to get guys into the big time, even though you were already there.
Well, you know what? It did work that way for a while, but I didn't go to WWE until like 1993, and they were, you know, they really hit big in like 85. So we held out here in Memphis as long as I could. And then when I went there in 93, then we did start working together hand in hand and using the Memphis area as a promotional or as a developmental company for the WWE. And that worked out okay for a while. You know, we did that till about 1996 or something like that.
Is the process to get into the WWE or hit the big time, as you will, is it the same now as it was back then? I mean, you're still eyed for your talent and your physical abilities and your way, your showmanship.
It is. It's just more difficult. The way back in the day and today, it's just sort of being in the right place at the right time or being seen by the right person.
Yeah.
You know, if and then of course, naturally you have to have the ability or you have to basically have what it takes, but still you may be a most gifted wrestler around and have a great physique and be able to talk like a gangbusters. But if you never get that introduction, if you never meet anybody that has the ability to put you in the right situation,
right,
you're just, you know, you're out of luck. So there's a lot of luck involved in finding a time or finding an opportunity to meet the right people to get your foot in the door.
Wasn't there a school for this sort of thing?
Oh my gosh, there's always been schools for wrestling. Yeah.
None of them officially sanctioned, mind you, but
no,
you know.
Right. I mean, you know, that was a thing. A lot of ex-wrestlers, once they got too old to actually wrestle themselves, they'd open up a wrestling school. And, you know, and yeah, if they had a little bit of a name, I mean, you could have 8 or 10 students and you're charging them a couple $100 or whatever like that. And you make yourself a good little living. But it's one of those things where, you know, you might bring a guy in and get a couple grand off of him over a few months, and then at the end of the time when he runs out of money or whatever, you say, well, congratulations, you're a wrestler. See you later.
Good luck.
Yeah, but what's he going to do? You know, that was always the problem with the wrestling schools. There were very few of them that could ever do anything for you on a professional level once you were trained, so to speak, you know.
Nowadays, I still see a lot of the underground stuff, the smaller clubs that are working. And it's kind of cool to see that because
we call them like independent wrestling shows.
Independent,
and they still spring up because, like I said, there are tons of guys out there that would love to be in the business and try to be try to be wrestlers. But there's only now with the WWE basically being the only game in town, there's only a certain amount of positions that need to be filled or that would be open, you know. So that's why the independent matches and shows have, I think they're kind of enjoying a resurgence, an increase, you know, because they're just there's so many guys out there that want to get involved, and so the promoters will, you know, take a chance on these guys and put on shows and
so they send out like talent guys to go look for them and, you know, go look and watch some of these matches.
Well, you know, the WWE now has a developmental company down in Orlando, Florida, and it's called NXT, which basically, hey, who's next, you know? But they right now already have about 75 to 80 young guys and girls that are in training that's their job. They're already under contract, and all they do is train every single day, you know,
get their game down and
and it's just trying to, you know, it's basically exactly like minor league baseball.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's the organization that's getting ready to send these guys right up to the major leagues, and that's what we have now. And they're able to do that without really, they don't really send out talent scouts. It's a situation where wrestlers through the internet, WWE.com, they have a way to, you know, get their resumes or their tapes and that sort of stuff to the people at WWE, which is headquartered in Stamford, Connecticut. And you know, that's. They just get inundated with
many
guys.
Yeah, there's so many guys.
Hey, look, hey, man, I'm the next John Cena. Here I am. Just give me the shot. Oh, you know, put me on the main event on Monday Night Raw or Thursday Night SmackDown. And so they really don't have to send out talent scouts. They've just got a wealth.
Because talent keeps coming in.
Talent comes to them, yeah.
Yeah, because wrestling is so big. I mean, you and I were talking about this long before about how large the audience for, I mean, internationally.
Oh, worldwide. It really is. We just got, you know, our big thing now is the WWE Network, which for years WWE has been a pay-per-view driven company where, you know, they put on live events and everything and they have the live TV show, the Monday Night Raw and the Thursday Night SmackDown that basically the whole purpose of that was been to channel everybody into getting them tuned in and ready to buy that pay-per-view every month. And
the story goes on during the week on the pre-shows and then that pay-per-view
exactly.
At the end of the
month.
That's
the blow-off, you know. Yeah. Hey, that's where everything's going to culminate. And so, and that was always a situation over the years where, you know, you pay, now the prices have gotten crazy. You know, you pay $59.95 for a pay-per-view and, you know, then you invite half your neighborhood over to come over and watch the WWE pay-per-view, the WrestleMania or whatever, you know, one of the monthly pay-per-views. And that's the way the company is run since it's basically been in existence. But now All that has changed, the new age of streaming video and everything. Now WWE has their own network. So the pay-per-views are on the WWE network now. And the great thing about this, and it's not only the pay-per-views, but I mean there's endless hours of archived
older matches and stuff,
old shows and matches. Yes, everything that's ever happened in the WWE is on the network on demand, and then plus they have 4,000 hours of every week of like new programming.
Right.
But the main thing is every month the pay-per-views are now on the network, and you subscribe to the network. Whereas used to you pay $40 or $50 for that one pay-per-view. Now you subscribe to the WWE Network. You got it 24 hours a day, all week long, plus the pay-per-view every month for $9.99.
What a steal.
What a steal. It's crazy. Steal.
Perfect for the fan.
For the fan. It cuts out, but I mean, you know, it's made some people mad. It cuts out Comcast and the DirecTV and all
that. Everything's moved onto the web. You know,
everything's moved onto the web. So yeah. You got the WWE Network that is going crazy. We just last month it started in United Kingdom, in England, so that became available to everybody in the United Kingdom. Just last week, it became available in the country of Japan.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, and it's the same thing there. Over you get the network for $9.99. So you can imagine how many millions of people now are paying $10 a piece a month.
Making far more money doing it that way.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because of the volume at that point.
Yes,
and it's
absolutely
affordable to the fan. I mean, it's
absolutely. I mean, it really is. It really is an unbelievable bargain for the amount of programming that you get on there. I can't tell you, you know, I'm on Twitter. How many I get tweets every single day of people just sending me a random tweet saying, hey, I'm watching Royal Rumble from 1995. And the man, what you said to JR about this and that is hilarious. And this, so it's just crazy. You know, you can watch any event that's ever happened in the WWE on the network anytime you want to.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. But it's fun also. I hear from people that reminded me of things that I hadn't even thought about. And I go, golly, I'll have to go back and take a look at that again. You know, but
do you ever do that? You ever go back and look at some of those old matches from days gone by?
Honestly, no. I do not. I see enough.
You don't
want
to remember.
I see enough of the new stuff, Rick. It's hard. You know what? When my DVD, my compilation DVD came out a few months ago in the WWE, the first time, been there 23 years, and they finally put out a 3-disc DVD set on me. But I did go back, you know, when watching that when it first came out, and watched a lot of the great thing about it has a lot of the old Memphis matches on there, and then a lot of the matches that I had once I got in the WWE on there. So, but yeah, I guess I shouldn't say no, I never do, because I occasionally do. And now, like I said, I mean, somebody'll throw up something to say, you know, with a link to a match on YouTube, and they'll tweet it to me, and I'll just hit that, and next thing you know, I'm watching a match from 1976 or something like that that I was in at the Mid-South Coliseum, you know.
Do you have any idea how many matches you've been involved in over the years?
Oh,
probably, I would think it's countless at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know what's funny is you run into fans that will expect that you have actually kept a record of your wins and losses.
Right, yeah, it's like you have a book.
Are you kidding me? I don't even know how many matches I had, much less how many wins or losses I had. I do know somehow, because it's on Wikipedia, that one distinction I have, I've won the most championships of any wrestler in the history of professional wrestling.
Will
I won 168 championships in my 40-plus year career.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing. You know,
that's a staggering number,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. I mean, they make a big deal out of Ric Flair being 16-time world champion. You know,
and yeah,
I
but you've done it 168.
I won 168 championships.
Rookie.
Yeah, right.
Out of all of those matches, are there some that stand out in your mind still that you think about?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean
there's got to be those benchmark.
Well, you know what? Probably the one that the most people that are not even wrestling fans remember was the match I had with Andy Kaufman at the Coliseum in 1983. That sort of redefined my career and it's
immortalized.
It put wrestling and myself on a nationwide scale before cable hit. In 83, you know, it was almost impossible to get any kind of national publicity on any of the networks or anything for wrestling.
Yeah.
And like I said, it was all localized and everything. But when Andy Kaufman came down to Memphis and we wound up having that match, and I gave him the pile drivers. He went to the hospital, neck in a brace for six months. Oh, yeah. Then we wound up on the David Letterman show, which, by the way, being on the David Letterman show with Andy Kaufman and me wound up slapping him and that whole situation, that is still to this day in one of the top 100 moments in the history of television.
Oh, in the history of television?
Yes, that's in the National Museum of Radio and Television in Washington, D.C. It's like number 87 in the top 100 moments in the history of television. Well, isn't that crazy?
You slapped the snot out of him.
Yeah, I did.
That was a full-on hit, too.
Yeah, right? it was a full-on hit, and a lot of people, you know, wonder about how, you know, it was at all predetermined. And in actuality, that is one of the things that is always fun for me to go back and watch. And by the way, you just pull it up on YouTube, and they have the version that aired on TV, and then they had the unedited version on there as well, where Andy Kaufman just comes back out on the show and cusses like a sailor.
During their commercial break, is what it was?
No, it was when we went back on the air.
Back on.
Yeah, of course. And then when he did that, after I'd slapped him, he comes out and he starts this tirade of swearing and curse words. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way this is going to air. What's he doing? Is he crazy? You know, but sure enough, got back to the hotel, turned the TV on that night, and they aired every bit of it. All they did was they didn't actually beep the curse words out. Yeah. They put in the sound of a cuckoo clock, which made it even funnier.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Andy starts cursing, and all of a sudden you hear, cuckoo, 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 cuckoo. And it was. It was just hilarious. It couldn't have been. And people ask me all the time, you know, what did you and Andy have that all pre-planned, and did you know you were going to do that? And the honest to God's truth is it was not. It was just something that happened. Nobody on the Letterman show, I say nobody knew it was going to happen. Even I didn't know what I was going to slap Andy before I just got up and slapped him. It was all, and that's why when I watch it back, it's like an out of body experience. It's like I'm really watching somebody else, because I knew we were into the second segment of the show, and I knew we were going off after this. And what was supposed to happen, Andy was supposed to apologize to me for making fun of wrestling. I was supposed to apologize to Andy for giving him the pile driver, and Andy was going to get up and sing What the World Needs Now Is Love, Sweet Love. That was going to be the last segment that we were on the Letterman show.
And he went in a completely different direction.
Yeah, he didn't ever apologize. And so I didn't ever apologize. And then it got just more heated and heated. And then Dave finally said, well, guys, we're going to have to take another break and kind of get this sorted out. And I knew after that we were going to be off, right?
Yeah.
So Paul Schaefer and the band started playing the music to lead into the commercial. And I just stood up, looked Andy in the eyes, and just slapped the taste out of his mouth and knocked him right over out of his chair. And when I watch it back now, and if you watch it, you got to watch Dave's face. That's all I do when I watch the slap, I just look at Dave's expression.
He was shocked, wasn't he?
Oh my gosh, he was so shocked. It was like, I don't think he could even believe it was happening. If you look at Dave, we're over to his right, and all Dave was doing was just staring straight into the camera, looking at some papers. And I know he just saw it out of the corner of his eyes, but I think he didn't want to believe that what just happened, you know? So he just kept looking down or staring straight ahead. And
this is the producer's job at this point.
and of course, Dave said later, it was the first time that he had ever knew that he completely lost control of the show.
Yeah.
You know, and he was really upset about it for a long time. Except the fact that the very next day, this is in the first year of Letterman show being on late night. And the very next day, boom, there it was. He was plastered pictures of me, him, and Andy all over the front page of New York Times, New York Post, every newspaper, every news show. Everything was talking about what happened on the David Letterman show last night. You know,
didn't hurt him any. That's
no,
for sure.
It didn't hurt his ratings at all.
So in the movie Man on the Moon with Jim Carrey. Y'all recreated that scene.
We recreated it to a T. As a matter of fact, I tried to slap Jim Carrey harder than I slapped Andy.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I didn't like Jim Carrey at all. We didn't get along at all.
Because Dave is there too, so that must have been kind of surreal for him to sort of re-witness
this. It was a funny situation, in the fact that Dave is a weird duck.
Yeah,
I love to watch a show. I really miss it now that it's off. I mean, I was a huge fan of David Letterman, but apparently he's. I don't think eccentric is the right word. I don't know. He's just a different guy, you know. And so when we're getting ready to shoot this, the scenes there at the late night show, I get word that this is a big event. I mean, at the time, Jim Carrey was like the biggest star in Hollywood. Yeah. You know, he just getting ready to do The Grinch. He just finished. I mean, he was the biggest, hottest star going. And so, you know, here he is doing this movie. David Letterman has agreed to be in it, which Letterman doesn't do anything. You know, he wouldn't agree to be in any kind of other shows ever. And so he's agreed to do it. But the funny thing was, you know, this was what we shot the movie in 99 or something like that. And right. It was supposed to be happening in 83. And Dave refused to do anything, to wear any kind of makeup to make himself look younger. Or to look like he did back in the day. So it was a kind of a weird situation. All of a sudden, you know, here's this. Here we are on the Letterman show, and from supposedly 1983, but here's Dave looking like 1999, right? and the other thing was I guess he begrudgingly agreed to do the scenes, and he said, "I got to give you guys 1 hour." And he said, "That's all I can be here is 1 hour, and if we can't get it done by then, I got to go." And so we, you know, we were really under pressure. You know, you how movie shoots are. I mean, you know, you might hurry up and wait. So we were under the gun to get it basically done in one take. And so we did. And the reason we did was because after I slapped Jim Carrey, he got up and told Milos Forman, the director, he said, "Well, I hope you got that because I'm not taking that again.
I'm not doing that again."
That's exactly what he said. So anyway, it was a unique experience there doing that movie.
Made your point with Jim, though, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, the funny thing about Jim Carrey was, I mean, Andy and I, you know, the real Andy Kaufman was just a marvelous guy. He was just the coolest guy to be around. He was friendly. He was humble. He was almost shy.
Kind of a sweet-natured guy.
Yeah, like he really was. And totally different character, you know, when the camera came on and everything. Andy and I were the same age, and he never, ever once, ever referred to me as anything other than Mr. Lawler. Wow. And I would tell him, I said, "Andy, Mr. Lawler's my dad. You don't have to call me that. I'm Jerry." Yeah. And it, okay, Mr. Lawler. And it's like that, you know, he was just such a respectful kind of guy. And so, but he put, you know, when he portrayed the character here in Memphis of the big star from Hollywood, people just couldn't stand him, you know. And so, and they thought that Andy and I just really hated each other because that's the way it came across on TV. Well, Jim Carrey, in playing Andy in the movie, he went above and beyond just playing a part. He was like, I mean, you had to be out in Hollywood to hear some of the stuff that was in Variety and all the talk trades about the movie as it was being shot. It was like Jim Carrey is channeling Andy Kaufman.
Right.
He would come every day in full makeup. You had to refer to him. Even Milos Forman directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, all these great movies. And even he had to refer to Jim as Andy. He wouldn't respond to anybody unless you called him Andy. You know, that's how in character he was, you know. So he thought in his mind and hearing about the history of us that Andy and I really despised each other. So Jim Carrey, being in character on and off the set, he acted like he and I were mortal enemies even during the shooting of the movie. I mean, he threw eggs at me. Oh, my gosh. The first day on the set, I was married at the time. My wife and I were like walking onto the set. I'm thinking, man, here we are in Hollywood, California. All of a sudden, boom, this big thing of like Gatorade or something comes in a jug bottle and bust right in front of us and splashed all up on her dress and all over me. And I'm thinking, what the crap? And I look at him, it's Jim Carrey going, "Lawler, I'll get you." Just, you know, and it's like, what? I mean, it was just you know, so he did all sorts of things that were just really irritating all during the movie. It got so bad at one point I went to Milos Forman. I said, "Milos, has he even read the script? Does he not realize that Andy and I were actually friends and that sort of thing?"
Do a little bit of research on it.
Yeah. And he says, "Oh, Jerry, I don't know. You know, that's just him. I have no control over him." So anyway, he was so into being Andy Kaufman that we had a scene where, you know, the actual pile driving, the match scene, they rented the Forum in L.A. and they fixed it up to where it was supposed to be, the Mid-South Coliseum here in Memphis. And they brought 4,000 extras for this scene. You know, they fill up this L.A. Forum here with all of these people. in the stands. And here we, Jim and I are going to do the wrestling scene where I pile drive Andy. And like a week before I fly out to Hollywood to do this, I get a call at like 1:30 in the morning and answer the phone. And it's Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Jim Carrey. And a guy from the move from Universal and a guy from the insurance company on a conference call. And they say, Jerry, we're sorry to wake you up at this time of night and everything, but we're just sitting here. We're having a big meeting, and Jim really wants to not use a stunt double on this scene.
He wanted to do it himself.
He wants you to give him the pile driver. And of course, we have the we have the insurance people here, and if anything happened to Jim, it'd shut down the production. It could really go over costs and all this kind of stuff. And Jim just wanted you to be able to assure these people that you could do it without hurting him. And I said, well, I probably...
It's a pile driver for
that. Yeah, it's a pile driver. It involves me sticking his head between my legs, turning him upside down, and dropping him on his head. I said, but, I can protect him.
Yeah.
I said, I've done it probably 500 times and never really hurt anybody seriously or anything
sure.
like that.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, well, that's probably what we're going to do. Anyway, when we get out there and get ready to shoot the scene... They changed their mind. They said, no, we don't, it's too risky. We don't want him to take the pile driver. And so, they had a stunt double.
They had a double that came
out. Yeah, this was awesome. They had a stunt double that looked more like Jim Carrey than Jim Carrey. It was so cool. This guy's dressing.
Out the attitude,
his
right?
face, yeah, everything. It looked just like him. I'm thinking, wow, this is awesome. So, we started filming the scene and, I grab Jim Carrey and I stick his head down between my legs and I grab him around his waist and I pick him up with his feet dangling in the air and the director yells, cut. And so I gingerly let him down and he gets up and he walks over to the corner. In comes the stunt double. I pick him up. I put his head between his legs, pick him upside down. The director yells, action. Boom. I drop this guy down on his head, right? Yeah. Bang. He flops over and the director yells, cut. He gets up, goes off to the side. Jim Carrey comes in and lays down on the mat right there. And then that's how the scene went, right? Yeah. The action. And so I pick him up again. And so that's the way the scene went. And we wound up shooting this thing.
A thousand times.
Oh,
yeah, it just goes on and on.
It just went on and on. And the people in the audience were getting restless. And I was getting tired of this. So the same old crap over and over. And then finally, some of the people started razzing Carrey, right?
Yeah.
And then... Come on, Carrey. These are stunt paid extras, right? Carrey, why don't you take a pile driver? What's the matter with you?
Yeah, the stunt guy just did it like 40 times.
Right.
He's fine.
Exactly. So, Milos Forman says, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to do one more take, and that is it. I promise you all, we thank you so much for your patience. One more take. We think we've got what we want, but we can assure you we do one more take, and we'll have it. And so they're rearranging just a light or two here and there and everything. And so while I'm standing there in the corner, Bob Zamuda, who was Andy Kaufman's really good friend and a consultant on the movie, he's over there. He's been talking with Jim Carrey all the time. They've become big buddies. So all of a sudden, Bob Zamuda comes waltzing over here to by where I am, and he's like looking all around, and it's just like he's, and then all of a sudden out of the corner of his mouth, he says, Jerry. I said, yeah. He said, listen, just talked to Jim, and he said that on this next take, when you pick him up for the pile driver and Milos Forman yells cut, he said, you go ahead and pile drive him. And then that way they'll have it on tape and there'll be nothing they can do about it. He just wants to go and take the pile driver. And I said, okay. So he turns around, he walks off, right? And now I'm thinking, I know what the son of a gun wants to do. I knew it the minute he said it. He wants me to pile drive him. And he is going to lay there like he's got a freaking broken neck for real.
Yeah.
And he's going to go to the hospital, and he's going to come out with
Andy Kaufman.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what Jim Carrey has got in his mind, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, this is going to make me look like the biggest jerk ever, because they're going to think I just went ahead and did this on my own, right? The directors and the producers. So, I stood there for a couple minutes, obviously, and here comes Milos Forman walking by the ring. He's on his way to get ready to start the scene, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, Milos. And he goes, yes, Jerry. So I lean down and I tell him, I said, Bob Zamuda just came over to me and said, on this take, he wants me to go ahead and really pile drive Jim.
And he goes, "Oh, Jerry. Oh, I'm so glad you told me, Jerry. Thank you. Oh." And so he goes on the microphone and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. We have everything we need. Thank you very much for coming, folks.
He didn't
Thank
even
you.
Want to get involved.
No, he's yeah. so he's so he, all of a sudden people start getting up and I look over and Jim Carrey is looking at me and he's like furious.
Oh, yeah, like you sabotaged
yeah,
his bit.
I sabotaged his whole bit, right?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Jim Carrey comes over and gets right in my face. Right, I'm just standing there. Now, there's 4,000 people around. Jim Carrey comes and gets right in my face, and I'm looking at him, and what do you think he did? All of a sudden, he just goes,
"Pleh!" Oh, no, he spit on you.
He spit right in my face, and I'm thinking, what the?
What an ass.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, I just, when he did it, he spits in my face, and then all of a sudden, his eyes get big, like he's, all of a sudden, I just look.
He's like, "Holy shit, what am
yeah,
I
what
doing?
Am I just doing?" And so he turns and starts running. I snapped. I'm just freaked out, right? And I start running after him. He's trying to dive through on the other side of the ring where he's got, there's about a, this guy was maybe 6'8", yeah. weighed about 400 pounds, big black bodyguard right. that was trailing Jim Carrey all over the place. Carrey dives through the ropes, but he doesn't know how to do it, like where he could dive out head first, get out. He tries to slide his feet out first, and he's holding onto the second rope, and his head's still in there. Well, I caught him in what we call a reverse chin lock, right?
Yes.
So I got his head in, I got his head and his neck in my arms in a vice grip, and I'm pulling him back in the ring, and this 400-pound bodyguard sees him. He grabs his ankles, and he's trying to pull him out of the ring.
Tug of war.
We got a tug of war going on with the biggest star in Hollywood, right? And I'm pulling him, and this guy's pulling him, and he's screaming, And so this went on for like maybe 10 seconds, and I'm thinking suddenly people are just stunned. They're going, "What the hell is going on?" Right?
Yeah.
So then I realize, hell, I can't beat up Jim Carrey right here in front of all these people. I'll get sued, you know. So I let him go. This guy pulls him out. Boom, he falls onto the floor from the ring apron, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's going around like the president's just been assassinated. Oh, my God. It's like the biggest thing you've ever seen, right? So they call an ambulance, rush him to the hospital. This made this in Hollywood, you had to be out there in California and LA, Hollywood. This made huge news. You know, it was bulletins on Jim Carrey injured by the professional wrestler on the set of Man on the Moon.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was like there was a big hurricane going on in Florida where people were being, houses being destroyed, people were being killed and everything.
Yeah.
And this was the lead story on the 11 o'clock news in yeah. California.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Leaving out the provocation, of course.
Yes, exactly. And then all of a sudden, you know, here's his manager they're doing an interview with his manager. Nobody even came and talked to me. His manager said, "Well, this Mr. Lawler, this professional wrestler, acted so unprofessionally. He injured Mr. Carrey, and we don't know how severe the injuries are." So sure enough, I get word that I'm fired from the movie. Right? So I go home the next day. Jim Carrey has me fired from the movie,
uh-huh.
and he's in a neck brace.
Oh, God.
Day. Yeah, just like Andy, he's in a neck brace. And this went on for like maybe 3 weeks or so. I didn't hear anything from anybody. And I heard that they're going to have somebody else come in and reshoot all the scenes involving me with a different
actor.
Yeah. Right. And then I just kind of heard this. But then all of a sudden, like 3 weeks later, I get a phone call from Danny DeVito again.
Yeah.
And because Danny was like the executive producer on the movie and that sort of thing. It was his movie company that shot it.
Yeah.
And he said, "Jerry?" I said, "Yes. It's Danny DeVito." I said, "Yeah. Hey, Danny, how are you?" And he's just like, "We was wondering if you could be in New York next week and shoot the Letterman scenes." And I said, "Well, yeah, I can be. I thought I was fired from the movie." "Well, oh, no, that's awesome. That's everything's okay. That's all smoothed over. It's everything's good, you know." So I get my plane tickets, my itinerary. I go to New York. Here we go. We're walking into the Ed Sullivan Theater, right? And I'm outside. It's cold outside. I'm walking to the theater. All of a sudden, bang! Right in front of me on the sidewalk, two eggs hit, right, and bust wide open. I look down. I look up, and like four floors up, here's Jim Carrey with his head sticking out of the window. "I'll get you, Lawler." It's like, what the hell is wrong with this guy, right? And so, but then when I get inside, he comes over to me. He like gives me a big hug. He said, "Oh my gosh, this has been so much fun working with you and everything. Here, I got you a present." He gives me this little nice North Face jacket and everything. Yeah, weird. And, but then I realize, I guess he realized that what we're about to film is the scene of me slapping the crap out of him, right? He's thinking, I better make friends with this guy before he's going to kill me after what happened out there in this Hollywood. So anyway, then that led up to the fact that I did slap the taste out of his mouth harder probably than I actually slapped Andy Kaufman when we shot the scene. And he said, I hope you got it on that one take because I can't do that again.
Can't do that again. And if you, I guess you've never heard from any of those guys.
Well, you know what? It was funny in the fact that I did it just, I say recently, it's probably been not quite a year ago.
Yeah.
Out of the clear blue, I get a call from Hollywood and Mr. Lawler, I said, I can't remember her name, but anyway, she said, I'm Jim Carrey's secretary, and I was just wanting to get your address. Jim has something he wants to send you. And I said, okay, what is it? And she said, oh, it's a surprise. But just let me get your address, and I'll send it out. So I give her my address, and so a few days later, this box comes, right? This box. And is the weirdest thing. I open it up, and here's a letter inside from Jim Carrey that says, it was the weirdest thing because apparently – after reading this letter, apparently I figured out somebody must have sent him or given him the wrestling outfit that I wore during the movie. It was like the costume people had it made.
Right.
And it was a custom piece that with his big shoulders and his cape and everything. Somebody must have somehow given that to Jim Carrey, and he thought that I was giving it to him because it said on there, he said, Dear Jerry, the costume that you wore during our movie, Man on the Moon, is probably the greatest gift I've ever been given by anyone that I've worked with. And he said, I just wanted you to know how much I appreciate it. And it'll go down in something, you know, as one of my most treasured possessions. And he said, working with you was both but something like an odyssey and something, you know, he's just like, tell me how great and how much fun it was working with me and everything. And he said, I know you're into music. And he said, I just wanted to send you along something from my personal collection that I went through the other day, and I wanted you to have these. And what he sent me was a package of about like 6 or 7 LP album, record albums,
right,
all done by professional wrestlers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah, right. I mean, like,
I may have some of these in my collection.
Here's an album done by Antonio Rocca, this guy that used to wrestle back in the 50s with an album by a wrestler called Sweet Daddy Siki. The Hulk Hogan album was in there. It was like 7 or 8 just the most obscure wrestler albums, you know, something like the stuff that I'd done, you know, over the years. And for some reason, Jim Carrey had these in a collection, and he sent them all to me. And then he also said, by the way, I have a suite at the Staples Center for any event. I said, I would love to have you as my guest the next time you're in L.A. at any event at the Staples Center. Signed, you know, your friend forever, Jim Carrey. And, of course, he didn't put a way to get in touch with him for the event at the Staples Center, right?
Right.
So that hasn't happened. But anyway, I just thought that was the weirdest thing out of the blue.
Maybe that was his form of an apology to you. You know, maybe he's that awkward. I don't know.
No, maybe he's that odd.
Yeah, well,
he's just an odd guy, really. Anyway, it was quite an experience. And a long story. I'm sorry to bore you.
Well, no, that's quite all right. I've never heard that story before. That was fascinating because that whole thing with you and Andy, that's such a part of Americana.
Yeah, it really did become. I mean, it was. I look back and I really think that it was part of changing the direction of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
Up until then, it was like,
it's like it had its place, but now it could step out.
Yeah, I mean, and it involved, suddenly it was all right to involve show business and Hollywood. And the funny thing was, Andy Kaufman had actually gone to Vince McMahon Sr. in New York. Andy was from Long Island, and he went to a show in New York and told the promoter, hey, I was it any way possible? I've been wrestling women on my comedy shows and on the Merv Griffin show and things like that, and Mike Douglas show. I would love to do it, though, in front of a wrestling audience. Is there any way possible I could be a part of one of your shows and come and wrestle women out of the audience? And this is the way the business was back at the time. Apparently Vince McMahon told him, he said, look, Andy, he said, I appreciate it, but our fans are so skeptical. I don't want to give them a reason to think that we're involved with acting or actors or anything like that. He said, you know, I'm going to pass on that. And just lucky for me, a friend of mine who was also a friend of Andy's named Bill Apter was a magazine writer up there, overheard this conversation, and he told Andy, he said, hey, I got a friend, Jerry Lawler, down in Memphis, has a wrestling company. I think he would really be interested in doing. So he put the two of us together, and that's how that all came about. But,
Yeah, it was just, it was then when we did what all we did and it wound up getting national coverage, we wound up, you know, first of all, the pile driving match, it got all kind of news coverage that Andy Kaufman was injured. They thought he had a broken neck,
three days
in the hospital in Memphis after a match with a professional wrestler. That was big news. Then when we went on the David Letterman show and all that happened, boom, that was just all exploded. And what happened, Vince McMahon was sitting up there saying, damn,
we should have had that.
I could have had this.
Yeah.
It was offered. It was put in my lap, and I turned it down. And it got such news that immediately after that, the WWE and Vince McMahon brought in they brought in Cyndi Lauper and put her with Captain Lou Albano, had her in his music, had him in his music video. Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Then they brought in and they involved her in a match. Then after that, they brought in Mr. T. They brought in, just all sorts of celebrities started getting involved, and it just snowballed. And I'd like to think that, you know, the Andy and I was the thing that kind of changed the direction of where, hey, you know, this is entertainment, it's sports entertainment, let's bring in the entertainment world and get them all involved. And now, you know, it's just everywhere.
It's hand in hand.
Yeah.
I mean look at Dwayne Johnson, The Rock.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
exactly.
You got a guy that went from the ring into big time films, and now isn't he coming back?
He's going to be back at WrestleMania this year.
Wow.
Yeah, down in Dallas in April.
A lot of these guys, you can't get them out of the ring long enough. They got to come back. And
you know, once it's sort of like radio, Rick, as you probably know.
Yes.
It's something that if you really love it, it gets in your blood, and you'll never be the same unless you stay involved with it some kind of way. It's just something that's part of you.
I think it's because, at least from my perspective, as far as being in this business in radio, you start on such a small scale and you put so much into it and you pay your dues and you work your way through, and then you finally get a taste of how fun it really is.
Yeah.
That you don't want to put that effort away.
No, and it becomes your life's work.
Yeah.
And I think radio is similar, almost any form of entertainment. But, you know, the old saying, if you have a job that you love, you never really work a day in your life.
That's true.
And that's the way I felt. I've had a wonderful career. I've made a lot of money, made a lot of friends. And I honestly, if you put a lie detector on me, I could say I've never had to work a day in my life.
Yeah.
And it would pass, because that's the way I feel.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like work. It's like doing something you love.
That's fun. That's an awesome thing to have.
Yeah.
You know, because every day you get to go to work. Now you're doing the Thursday night shows. Is that right?
Thursday night SmackDown. Now we just moved to a USA Network.
Yeah.
And that's going to be huge for us. So now Monday Night Raw is on USA and Thursday night SmackDown is on USA. And, you know, it'll be two of there's the number one and two longest running episodic television shows in history.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they're going to be on the same network and huge worldwide coverage. It's just going to be big.
You know, I still go back and I find myself, I've never really been a huge fan of it.
Right, right.
As of, like, I don't know, the past 6 months, maybe a year, I find myself every once in a while stopping and watching a little bit of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because
it's fun.
It's fun. And you get back in touch with the innocence of it, of the kids, you know, because the kids just go crazy for you.
It's funny that, like you said, I've been in the business 45 years, but still the audience, you know, is the kids, the new generation coming along, and they, you know, they know me as well as, you know, as these new stars. And the network is so amazing about that, too, is because they have a lot of the old stuff on there. And in my house, you know, my girlfriend Lauren is a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
And the network, WWE Network, is like the greatest babysitter that I've ever come across. When he'll get home from school or
playing right in front of it, and
he'll watch it for hours, literally.
Wow.
And he'll go back and watch all the old shows, and you know, he sees me from, you know, 1995 and me in there beating up Bret Hart or stuff like that. And it's a cool situation.
Well, I think you guys become larger than life in a way.
What happens
in that ring is just so, it's larger than what, like, the Romans did with the gladiatorial combat, you know. There was that there's that flash, there's that circus environment, and it's fun.
I have a good friend, and you know, I do artwork as well, and I've done some stuff for different comic book companies, and that was my dream growing up. I wanted to draw Superman. I just had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago. I was in LA, and the DC Comics, Superman and Batman and all those people, they just moved their headquarters from New York to Los Angeles. And I had an opportunity to go out and visit their headquarters. And it was amazing how many wrestling fans work at DC Comics. And we got to talking and everything. And it was like, you talk about larger than life, these superheroes.
It's so similar to our business. I mean, you know, it's good guys against bad guys, and those people are writing stories every week or every month for these comic book characters, and it's just exactly like wrestling. I mean, you know, it's good guys and bad guys, and they're bigger than life, and they're superheroes to some parts of the audience.
Supervillains.
Yes,
and now
exactly,
it's everything.
And it's just a very similar situation, and it's you know, it's gone on since the beginning of time, and I don't think there'll ever be an end to it.
Maybe someday they'll get you to guest artist as and do a Superman episode in a book.
Well, I'm not going to rule that out because there is a possibility. I got to meet all the right people. Jim Lee, the big shot editor there, and everything. And he said, you know, Jerry, send me some of your work. You know, I said I'd be interested in doing something. But I mean, hey, it's a win-win situation. You know, I'm not gonna want any money for it. And all of a sudden, here you got a person. I got 1.2 million Twitter followers. And all of a sudden, you know, if I'm doing a piece of art for DC Comics for Superman magazine, you know, it's going to be publicized to a lot larger audience than they ordinarily have, you know.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it couldn't hurt anything. I mean, and it's not like I would draw like a stick man with a cape on him or something.
No, I've seen your work. No, it's cool. It's very good.
Thank you.
Speaking of the Superman, he's going to get the new movie with the Batman coming up.
I'm really looking forward to that.
You looking forward to that?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I've just been sort of disappointed with the Superman franchise. I thought it's been tough. Yeah,
yeah.
It just wasn't really happy with it. Batman, on the other hand, I think, you know, they did a good job with the Batman stuff. But I'm old school. I go back to the George Reeves, which, by the way, the old TV Superman.
Yes.
You know, day before yesterday would have been his 101st birthday.
Really?
Yeah, that's how long ago that guy was around, you know. But you know what? The lady that played Lois Lane, Noelle Neal,
yes,
still around. I just got a Christmas card from her.
Really?
This year. Yeah, I had the opportunity to meet Noelle several times, and just a wonderful little lady. She's got to be in her 90s.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, she's probably the last one. Yeah, Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen, just passed away a few months ago. But, yeah, I was a huge, huge Superman fan. And like I said, old school. Loved that George Reeves Superman.
Yeah.
Loved Batman, Adam West, Burt Ward, you know, those guys from the 60s TV show. I got a Batmobile, you know.
Yes.
I got that Batmobile. It's in my garage right now. And so, yeah, I've just...
It'll stay there till the spring probably, because it's kind of unpredictable to be driving it around now.
Yeah,
it doesn't have a roof on it.
Exactly. No roof on the Batmobile, no. So,
you got drain plugs in the floor to drain it all the way. But you wouldn't want to get it wet.
No. Oh, no. I treat it like a baby. It's awesome.
That is so cool. Well, Jerry, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Did I take too long?
No, not at all.
Who's going to listen to this, really, Rick? Come on.
I don't know. Somebody will probably tune. They'll find some interest.
Yeah.
I'll make sure that Jim Carrey hears this.
Oh, that'll be awesome.
We'll see if we can
and
get
say, Jim, hey, Jim, how about sending me your phone number where I can get in touch with you about that suite at the Staples Center?
Yeah, there might be an event for you to go to. Well, listen, anytime you're around, you want to get something out there, let me know, and we'll sit down and do it again.
I love it, Rick. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode from Radioland with Rick Cheddar.
Our good friend, Mr. Willie Hall, is here.
The collaboration of the idea that whoever initiated it, John, Dan, John Landis, some Universal executive, that the collaboration of that initial idea to go from an idea to an actual event, that just happened to be the catalyst for something that was unusually on time at that time.
It was lightning in a bottle.
When I first saw the Blues Brothers, I paid them no attention.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed what was going on, and I systematically I saw what was going on with every player and the whole image of what they were projecting. And then I tried to look into the authenticity, the soul of the performers, Danny and John.
For previous episodes, go to radio-memphis.com. To download episodes to your mobile device, search the show in iTunes, player.fm, stitcher.com, Pocket Cast, or TuneIn. And now, here's more with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
Everybody needs a lava lamp. I'm just making a statement here because I think it's true. Have one here in the studio. It's groovy. When groovy is a good word to use for it. When things get stressful around here, I'll take a moment, breathe, and stare into the weirdness and the abyss that is a lava lamp. And I find myself being calmed down by it. Yes, you can have one too. We've got a source here in Memphis that is selling the original one, the original lava lamp, the one that started it all. The company is still in business. And, man, they've got some great designs, new styles. You can see them all at Wizards. They're a Memphis mainstay. They've been around a long time. Great alternative smoke shop, 1999 Madison Avenue. 7 days a week, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. online. Look for their banner ad at radio-memphis.com. You can click on that. You can buy one of the original lava lamps from them. They'll ship it right to you. It's a good deal. They're great people. We like to support our businesses around here, and that's one way to do it. Check out Wizards right here in Memphis, because it's still smoking. If you've been watching any television, there's no doubt you might have seen a commercial for the city of Memphis. Yeah, because the tourism group here have been advertising the city out to various outlets, and I typically see them on sporting events, so like when the Grizzlies are playing or if they're playing out of town, and they tend to run an ad for the city of Memphis. And one of the artists that you hear on this is a band that's been a longtime friend of Radio Memphis. You can get their music on their website. We'll tell you about them here in just a bit, and we'll tell you about this song here in just a while. But let's go ahead and get it on, shall we? It's a great song, and it's very indicative of the good Memphis sound that happens out of here these days. Ladies and gentlemen, Star and Micey with I Can't Wait.
I had you on the telephone, said you won't be coming home. Heard you had to leave the state, said you won't be back someday. Well, now I can't wait. No, I think you should stay. Yeah. I heard you went to Tennessee, thought that you'd come back to me, thought you said you'd never leave. Baby, please come home to me. Well, now I say a million things and everyone would mean something, but I can't wait. No, I can't you might be coming home. I know you had to leave the state. Now you're coming back someday.
You can find the record, starandmicey.com. I can't wait. It's part of their EP that they have available now. Their website has all their tour dates, has some videos and stuff. And you can get the I Can't Wait EP. It's out now. So you can get it on CD or vinyl. You better act fast before they go away. Check them out, starandmicey.com. Well, you heard what's coming up last time, or next time rather, and you all the fun stuff there. We got some great shows of this new format. I'm kind of digging it, kids. Kind of liking what we're doing here, so we're going to have a lot more fun. You want to write the program, drop us a line, radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to get on the show, or if you'd like to book us, we can handle it that too, because we're going to be branching out, and we're going to be heading out onto the road here before too terribly long. So if you want to get in on it, you want to learn more, I got Star and Micey in my head. Radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. Drop us a line. Say hello to us. And by all means, please continue to share the program to everybody that you know. We're found in all the usual places. You heard from Joel. He told you where we're at. So that's it for it this time around. We'll see you later. I'm Rick Cheddar. And this has been From Radioland.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. All music performed during this episode was used by permission. No part of this program can be rebroadcast or used in any other way except by written consent. For bookings and other inquiries, you can write the show by sending an email to radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. For more, go to radio-memphis.com.